The new book, Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches and Writings, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, gives readers a rare opportunity to engage with the Congresswoman's powerful ideas in her own voice. Many Americans are familiar with Chisholm's importance as the first Black woman in Congress and the first woman and African American to run for president with either major party. This collection of her work establishes Chisholm as an unparalleled public intellectual and Black feminist both in her time and now. Learn more about Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, at ucpress.edu.
Welcome to See How They Run, horse race coverage from the left, brought to you by The Nation. I'm Dee Dee Guttenplan, editor of The Nation. Earlier this week, the Kamala Harris campaign began what was described as its largest effort yet to reach one of the most crucial voting blocks in the 2024 election, Latinos. The push couldn't come soon enough. More Latinos are eligible to vote than ever before in U.S. history. They have the potential to play a decisive role in just about every key swing state in the presidential race. And as the last few elections have shown, Democrats simply can't afford to take their votes for granted. So today we're going to talk about Latino voters, what kind of power they have, the complex ways they are using that power, and what Democrats need to do to stop Donald Trump's aggressive bid to win their support. It's my pleasure to welcome two guests to this discussion. Bill Gallegos is a longtime Chicano activist and political organizer and a member of The Nation editorial board. And Jack Herrera is a reporter who has covered Latino politics and immigration for just about every major outlet you can think of, including The Nation. Bill, Jack, thanks so much for coming on See How They Run.
Thank you, Don.
Thanks, Don.
So the Pew Trust put out some interesting figures about Hispanic voters, including the fact that there will be 36 million eligible Hispanic voters this year, which is up from 32 million in 2020, and that represents fully half of all the new eligible voters in 2024. So this is a hugely important block, but let's start with this question. Are we wrong to think of it as a block? I mean, after all, do refugees from Castro's Cuba, people fleeing Venezuela, people fleeing Guatemala, people fleeing death squads that the U.S. has funded in Central America, do they all have politics in common, or do they have just the Hispanic language in common?
Well, maybe I'll start that off. So if I like the work that the UCLA Latino Policy and Politics Institute has done on this, where they actually looked at voting, not just exit polls. And generally the Latino vote, for example, in California, Wisconsin, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, went three to one for Biden. And so it's been pretty strong. And the largest Latino voting populations are the Mexican-American population, the Puerto Rican population, and Central Americans. But in New York, Dominicans have a big vote and are also overwhelmingly Democrat. So the Cuban-American vote is an anomaly in the larger Latino picture. But there are indications, though, that that Trump and the Republicans have made some impact on the Latino electorate. And there's been some movement, a small sector, but not insignificant when we're talking about swing states. But, for example, in the swing state of Wisconsin, Latinos are pretty decisive in that and pretty overwhelmingly Democrat. And if you combine the Black and the Latino vote in Wisconsin, it can make the difference in a state that now is up for grabs.
Jack, are we within our rights to talk about a Latino vote?
I think that most of the time that we're using that term, it's unsophisticated and it's not particularly useful. I think it can be. And I think that you have to think about the lenses of analysis where Latinidad does make a difference, where that is worth talking about. But to give you an example of why I sort of struggle to talk about it as one solid vote, I'll give you an example. I just got back from Albuquerque last night where I was reporting. And New Mexico is a really interesting state when you talk about the Latino vote. After the Mexican-American War, most of the Mexican citizens who were in the annexed territories were in New Mexico. So you can really think of Albuquerque, Santa Fe area as the heartland, one of the heartlands of Mexican-American identity. And so if you're in Albuquerque, you're meeting a lot of people who are second and third generation Mexican-Americans and a lot of recent immigrants as well. And so that identity is very, you know, sort of immigrant influenced, Latino. There's a lot of people who don't speak Spanish perfectly, but maybe spoke it with their grandparents. The sort of identity where, you know, you answer in English and your grandma answers in Spanish. If you go up north in Albuquerque, north of Albuquerque, you get to the northern part of New Mexico, meet a lot of people who don't call themselves Mexican. They'll call themselves Hispano or just Hispanic or Spanish because they trace their ancestry to the first Spanish settlers. And it's very important to them not to be identified as immigrants, not to be identified really as a racialized community. Even they think of themselves as European, having European ancestry. And then you go down to Cruces, Las Cruces, a little bit north of El Paso. And there it's a border town in a lot of ways. It's north of the border, but it's very Mexican, not just Mexican-American, Mexican. People speak with, you know, Chihuahua accents and Norteño music is playing in all the restaurants. And the reason I describe this is because each of those pockets have very different priorities, think of themselves very differently from each other, notice those differences when they drive in between these areas, all show up on paper as Latino. And so I think you have to think about those communities. These are all Mexican Americans too, right? And often from very similar parts of Mexico. And so the fact that there's so much difference within one state, within one ancestry community, I think that shows that you have to be really particular and smart about what are the similarities, what are the same senses of self, sensibilities, economic and cultural factors that are motivating a vote. And so I think that's why I'm glad we have the chance to talk today, Don, about to get to that next level of sophistication, because there are similarities. There's a meaningful way to talk about the Latino vote. You have to be smart about it.
Well, let's stay in New Mexico for a minute, because one of the interesting pieces of data I saw is that Hispanic voters make up 45% of eligible voters in New Mexico. So, you know, in a sense, the complexities within that state still ought to give you a good read on where Latino voters are, no?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think that, so New Mexico is one of the, what they call majority minority states. White voters, white people are a minority in that state. And so Latinos and also Native people have a lot of political power. And there's a lot of work in that. The community is very organized. I think that in a lot of ways, the most interesting thing about New Mexico is how working class it is and how underserved and, you know, to put it bluntly, very poor the state is. And I think I think class is often the most powerful way to talk about and understand the sort of vicissitudes or the sort of movements of the Latino vote. Because when you think about Latinos, what's a characteristic that is the same in New Mexico as it is in New York, as it is in Minnesota or Georgia or Pennsylvania? When it comes to Latinos, we're overrepresented among working class voters. We're overrepresented among non-college educated voters. And that's extremely true in New Mexico, where a huge percentage of the Latino population, a huge percentage of registered voters are working class, are, bottom quintile in the country. It's a very underserved state. And I think that dynamic is showing up in the voting. I think that in a lot of ways, for me, that's the thesis of the most explanatory power when we talk about why is there a right for movement among Latinos? Why is there so much energy among Latino conservatives? I think it's for the same reason that there's so much energy for Trump among rural voters or working class white voters. There's a similar sort of pull that the Trump and the Republicans, I think primarily Trump, but also the Republicans are succeeding in class de-alignment. Like they are polling working class voters. Like the party of the right is, there's a recent poll that there's a majority of Teamsters that are supporting the rightist party in this election. And I think that should throw up alarm bells for the Democrats.
Well, you know, I want to just say a little bit though, I'm my family's from New Mexico and Southern Colorado. So my family's from a little pueblito near Taos called Mora. And as you know, northern New Mexico is one of the poorest regions of the country. But of all the areas with large Latino populations, it's the most overwhelmingly voting, consistently voting Democratic. More than California, the percentages are higher than California, Arizona, Colorado, and Texas, and so on. So it's I think all of the things that Jacks are pointing out are very, very true. But I think we should look at the picture of what the voting pattern is. It doesn't mean that there's not some issues that we should be concerned about, because voters, Mexican-American voters, like many other Latino voters, feel that both parties fail to really address their issues and only come about in elections. And
that's
do
really
not
true.
Really
yeah.
Address our concerns on a more consistent day-to-day basis. But New Mexico is a strong, one of the strongest blue states in the country, and that's largely because of the Mexican-American vote. And Jack's right, the question of identity, I know when I grew up in Colorado, I was born in Pueblo. Our family was, like a lot of Mexican-American families in New Mexico and Colorado, we were farmers, lost our land, ended up in the coal mines, largely by the Rockefeller family in southern Colorado. We had family at the Ludlow Massacre when they were trying to unionize the mines. But when we were growing up, we were taught to identify ourselves as Spanish. And partly it's because of the historical connection there, but also it was to really hopefully blunt the racism that our mothers and fathers and grandparents suffered. That if we said we were European, but of course, when they heard Gallegos, well, you were a dirty Mexican.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the and you know, you saw those signs, no blacks, Negroes, dogs, or Mexicans allowed.
Yeah.
Even in my mother and father's time. So that was kind of the reality of the situation in that particular region. And that was, I think what you're pointing out, Jack, is true. It's, if we, like any population, we really need to look at the diversity. And I think the fact that our population, as is the African-American population, overwhelmingly working class, largely due to the racial institutional barriers that have kept us out of the professions, higher education, you know, other areas. So I think this is, this raises like what some of the issues are, like when the head of the Political Action Committee for LULAC, which for the first time in history endorsed in a presidential campaign and endorsed Harris, they said there was two issues. One that wasn't surprising was immigration. The other was education. Because for almost every Latino community, regardless whether it's Salvadoreño or Colombiano or Mexicano, education is still seen as a major avenue for social and economic uplift.
Right. I want to just drill down. I mean, you put a lot out there. I see like three topics I want to get to. What are the issues that Latinos feel are not being addressed by either party? And another is about this question of class, because you kind of zigged where I thought you were going to zag, Jack, when you said, you know, that, I mean, obviously Mexican-Americans, Latinos generally, like other ethnic groups, are fractured by class. And, you know, the wealthier members of that community tend to gravitate towards the Republican Party. That's something you see, you know, with Jewish Americans, with African Americans. But, you know, and in both of those two communities, there's a kind of stickiness to the Democratic Party as a hangover, if you like, from the New Deal days. But that's where I thought you were going to go. But instead you said, but actually they're making inroads among the Hispanic working class. And I want to know why you think that is and how that's happening. And, you know, we'll start with you, Jack, but we'll come to you, Bill, because I want to hear from both of you about how you feel that the Republicans are succeeding in doing this.
Yeah. Mike Madrid is a former Republican, you know, sort of never Trumper, former Republican, you know, one of the founders of the Lincoln Project. He has something that says a line pretty often that I do think I appreciate, which is that Republicans are succeeding with Latinos despite their best efforts. That the Latino messaging, like the Republicans' messaging for Latino voters, or the way they talk about race, the way they talk about immigration, the way they talk about equality and poverty, is terrible. Like, it's a bad message. It plays poorly with Latinos. It's so specifically like something. I'm not sure that they know why they've been doing so well, and they have been doing well. Like, I've been to plenty of majority Latino districts in Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, all over, where Trump is, you notice not just in polling, but in vote after vote, there is a rightward shift. Like, I think we need to be really clear about that. I don't know if Republicans totally understand why they're doing so well there. And I do think it comes down to, I think it's a very similar dynamic to why Teamsters voted earlier this week, you know, something like, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but something like 60-40 Trump over Harris, which is shocking. And so I think that sort of class delignment, this sort of working class interest in Donald Trump, in the politics he represents, it's not a monocausal answer, but I think that you're seeing that among working class Latinos. And I think that the reason why that's so important to talk about is, why have Latinos historically supported Democrats? Why did Obama win over 70% of the vote in 2012? I think it's because of the reliability that recent immigrants are going to vote Democrat, because discrimination and anti-racism are a big priority for someone who's a recent immigrant who speaks Spanish, has an accent, or maybe doesn't speak English yet, or or will not speak English. That sort of like being like, you're welcome, you belong, you're part of the fabric of this country. That instinct, that messaging from Democrats plays really well among recent immigrants. And then working class voters too, who have a history of, you know, union struggle, are interested, you know, priorities are housing and healthcare and the economy. A left party that offers, you know, like, hey, the rungs are broken on the bottom of the ladder of social mobility, let's get you some help. That's historically played well. And so the fact that now that branch of that part of Latinos that were reliably Democrat now suddenly is fracturing or becoming a little bit more wiggly. That's the real worry, that I think Democrats will still win the Latino vote this election. But the question is like, can they win it in the numbers that they need to win it in? Like, you know, high 50s, 60%. I think that if they were polling, if Harris was polling, if she was looking like she was going to win the Latino vote with Obama numbers, which is to say something like 70% of the vote, I think Pennsylvania would be in the bag. Georgia would be in the bag. Obviously, Arizona and Nevada would be in the bag. This would be a very different election if she'd been able to maintain that higher level of support, and she just hasn't been able to. And so this is around a lot of exposition, but to answer your question most succinctly, Don, is I think that what Trump offers disaffected working class white voters who overwhelmingly support him is this sense that, like, hey, these politicians who over the years always made you promises, this left party has said like they're going to support me with healthcare or education or immigration reform. They keep making these promises. The same people have been in office and nothing has happened. And I think that Trump is really seen as the change candidate in this election for a lot of people. Democrats seem like, you know, it's same old story, you know, like, and I think Latinos are both very cynical and very strategic with the vote. And the idea is that, like, Democrats on paper sound great, but hey, my life hasn't changed meaningfully under, you know, last 12 of the last 16 years have been Democrat rule. So, you know what? You guys lost your chance. Like, my status hasn't been normalized if you're an immigrant. You know, like, I don't own a house yet. My healthcare, I don't have good insurance or don't have insurance at all. My kids, you know, they didn't go to college. If they did go to college, they're saddled with a ton of debt and are working the same job I'm working. Democrats said all that thing was going to change. It didn't change. So, you know what? Let's try something new. I think that's generalizing, but that's a big part of the instinct here.
You know, just it's funny looking at the Teamsters, because there's 60% white, 61% white, but that means about 40%. It's about 18% Latino, 12% Black, almost 20% women, 4% Asian Pacific Islander. And my son's a Teamster. He works at a warehouse here in East Los Angeles. He was never polled. None of his shift was ever polled. I think a lot of it has to do with O'Brien as the leadership of the Teamsters, because even before this poll happened, you know, he was meeting with Trump. He was speaking at the Republican National Convention. I think there was already this thing was, I think it was pretty much rigged. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be concerned. But I think, you know, when I look at the voting patterns pretty consistently, even in the most recent elections, I think the Latino electorate, again, leaving aside the Cuban Americans, is very politically sophisticated. I mean, I know for my folks, the New Deal meant a lot. You know, that meant a lot. And we were like a lot of Latino families. We had picture of Jesus on the wall and a picture of Jack Kennedy. And, you know, a lot of that really was very, very meaningful to, I think, a lot of Mexican-American and other Latino voters. I think, you know, there's no doubt that folks are concerned, I think, about high prices, about the student debt, you know, about the high cost of healthcare, housing. Those are issues that kind of cut across. I don't see, and none of the research that I've seen indicates that they feel the Republicans have an answer to this question. So I think that the leaning is still going to be 60% plus for Democrats. But the problem with Latino voting is not so much, I think, the swing to the right, it's the sitting it out. Of all ethnic populations, we have the lowest participation rate as voters. And that continues to concern me. And I think for young Latino activists, this question of Palestine and Gaza is not meaningless. It's very, very important to these young voters. So I think there's issues that really need to be attended to. I think the Harris campaign is smart. I mean, I happen to know the person, one of the people in charge of that campaign, Julie Chavez Rodriguez. She's Cesar Chavez's granddaughter. She's very, very smart. And she certainly understands the importance of the Democratic Party and Harris, you know, putting resources and time and effort into reaching Latino voters. But there's no doubt that, you know, it's there are obstacles to overcome. But I think part of the problem is when Trump says, I will deport every single undocumented person, I don't think people have a concrete idea of what that would mean. So I'll just say in the neighborhood I live in, Southeast Los Angeles, a neighborhood called Linwood. It's working class black and brown neighborhood. Very stable. We don't have gangs. We don't have tagging. I mean, people really are together here. Every other house on our neighborhood would be impacted by this. Every other house. The school, it's down the block. The high school is down the block. The elementary school, it's two blocks away. The churches in these neighborhoods, the small businesses. I don't think people have a real, even among Latinos, an understanding of what this means, much less other communities. You know, the Haitian community, already we've seen what's going on with the Haitian community, which is a bullshit lie, how all of a sudden there's bomb threats and you know, just. So I think the idea that Trump said on day one, I will unleash a military campaign. And when they say 12 million undocumented, if we just do a conservative estimate of families, there are around 40 million people directly impacted. Not to speak of unions, which some of the highest growth in union density has been among Latino workers, and on Fight for 15, and organizing Amazon, and all of these different campaigns that are going on. Our schools, in many, many of the areas in the Southwest, but in other areas, Illinois, Latino students are a high percentage of the public schools. So I think people don't have a real clear idea of what this threat represents. And that it is a piece, but only it's the centerpiece of their political campaign, but it's only a piece of an overall effort, according to Project 2025, to really dismantle what's left of democracy in this country. So I think this is where the union leadership, I think, especially has been lax in getting out there and educating their members about what's going on and what's at stake in this election.
I agree with you about that, but I also wonder if people... You say people don't have any idea what this would be like. They don't have a clear picture of it. Isn't that also a flaw in the Harris-Waltz messaging? I mean, you know, we had a pretty clear picture of what was going to happen if Roe v. Wade was repealed because the Democrats spent a lot of time talking about it. They don't seem to spend any time wanting to talk about immigration. They seem to want to be running in the other direction.
The new book, Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches and Writings, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, gives readers a rare opportunity to engage with the Congresswoman's powerful ideas in her own voice. Many Americans are familiar with Chisholm's importance as the first black woman in Congress and the first woman and African American to run for president with either major party. This collection of her work establishes Chisholm as an unparalleled public intellectual and black feminist both in her time and now. Learn more about Shirley Chisholm in her own words, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, at ucpress.edu.
Well, she did. She was strong in her conversation with Domingo Garcia from LULAC. She was very strong on this and pointing this out. And she pointed it out in the debate with Trump. But yeah, they're weak. There's no getting around it. That this the defensiveness is the absolutely wrong strategy to be pursuing now. They have to have an offensive, affirmative approach to this. But, you know, that a lot depends on the unions and other social movements pushing them. They're getting pushed to move to the center. We have to push them to move to the left. And but, you know, the fact that most folks don't know about the consistent support for the Dreamers, for the idea that spouses of people who have residency or citizenship would be entitled to a path to residency, that's huge. That's a huge impact on immigrant communities. I think most people don't know it. I know my neighbor knows it because it affects him. He tells me. He's a Tejano who says, you know, I'm applying for citizenship. I'm on Trump's list if he gets elected. He knows exactly where I'm at.
I want to throw up a couple of cultural targets, and you guys can shoot them down as quickly as you want. But again, I'm thinking about this class de-alignment thing and specifically the Latino piece of it, because it seems to me that's the underlying trend that is the scariest in the country in a certain way, that the Republican Party is making a concerted and so far not entirely unsuccessful effort to go after working class voters. And so one cultural thing I want to throw up is I saw polls that said that when it was Biden at the top of the ticket, the Teamsters were 55% in favor of Biden. And now it's Harris and they're 55 or something like that in favor of Trump. Well, you know, how much is sexism, or to put a different spin on it, machismo, you know, an element in this shift, particularly among working class voters? So I want to ask you about that. And I want to ask you about something else, and you can take either of these on whatever you want. I was in Pennsylvania on Election Day in 2020 in Reading, and Reading has gone from a majority white city to a majority Latino city. The mayor was born in Puerto Rico and grew up in the Bronx. So I would go to polling places where the poll workers were having trouble because they didn't understand Hispanic naming convention. They didn't understand what, if you were, you know, Garcia Rodriguez, they didn't know which one should come first. They didn't understand. And it was just, people were waiting in line hours to vote. But I assumed these people waiting in line were Democrats because everybody there was, except the poll workers, everybody spoke Spanish. But in fact, they were mostly Republicans and they were mostly evangelicals. So that's the other cultural piece of it, is how much is, you know, how much is evangelical a factor in, you know, in this de-alignment? Because we haven't touched on that either. So, you know. Go ahead. Tell me I'm wrong to even raise these things.
Well, I think we can't discount sexism, but Latinos voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton, who was not a strong candidate, not an energizing candidate. But I think, you know, we can't discount that. It just means you have that. That's the work you have to do. You have to, you know, reach out to people. And I think there's this thing about Trump being a tough guy. You know, he speaks his mind. I think that does appeal to some younger Latinos. But I don't think it's locked in. But I think you have to do the work. You know, the Democrats have to do the work of getting out there and really having an organizing campaign that's relevant to this community. Because the way you would reach out to the Black community may be somewhat different. It has to be very specific and relevant. And the same way with, I think, different Latino communities. You know, if you're going to talk to Boriqueños in New York, you're not going to it's not the same way you're going to talk to Tejanos in South Texas. You know, that's just... That's the ABCs of electoral and organizing politics. And I think, you know, the Democrats need to do more of that. You know, the fact that in Texas, they keep running Beto O'Rourke instead of, you know, a stronger Chicano candidate there for office is mystifying to me. It's not that O'Rourke is a bad guy, but you have this huge Latino population. And that's one area where the gerrymandering was so bad that even the old Supreme Court, before the new 6-3 majority, said this is horrendous gerrymandering that clearly is going to limit the Latino vote. Too bad, we're going to let it go forward. So Tejanos have a really, huge challenge there. But, you know, there's a reason that the state, the Republican government does that, because they can't win on the fair and square among Latino voters in Texas.
Yeah, I mean, I want to go back briefly to the mass deportation point, which I do think kind of plays into beyond class, like what are the other issues at play? And you got to think that the Harris campaign is looking at the polling that shows that a majority of Americans and 41% of Democrats are at least interested in a mass deportation program. So I think when we talk about this, their policy and why they're weak on this issue or why they aren't playing offense, it's because of how profoundly sentiments have shifted in the last 4 years on immigration. In 2020, you had a high watermark of sympathy for people crossing the border, a high watermark of support for asylum and pathways to citizenship. And that has utterly cratered. I like to say that I think people like to talk about, you know, draconian border enforcement, draconian deportation enforcement, but then don't have the stomach for it when they see what that actually looks like. So I don't, you know, I think it's complicated to talk about, do Americans want mass deportation? I think, like Bill said, people start getting routed up as neighborhood, construction sites and agricultural fields go quiet. People, 70% of Latinos who are undocumented, or 70% of people who are undocumented are mixed status homes. So you have people being cuffed in front of American citizen children, in front of their parents. I don't think Americans will support that if they see it happen. But right now they do. They want that to happen. And I think that that's an expression of the vitriol. That's an expression of how much it freaks people out and frustrates them to see large numbers of immigrants crossing the border. And I think that that's a deep rooted in American history, that we immigrants are the pain sponge for all the other problems. You know, like there's tenement houses in New York. Whose fault is that? Is it the landlords? No, it's the immigrants. Like they're, I think that all those, you know, people put a lot of blame on that. And I think to really stress this point of how powerful an issue that is, Don, I got to tell you, I've talked to undocumented immigrants in Iowa, New Mexico, and Texas who want this deportation because they're long-term undocumented immigrants. And they say, these Venezuelans and Haitians, I've been waiting for my citizenship and they're coming and they're getting parole status. They're on a pathway to asylum. So they have work permit and they have more status than I do. And Biden's let them in. And you know what? Screw that. Like, they don't vote, obviously, but they're like, I don't support Biden because he's letting these newcomers in. And I'm undocumented, but I did it more the right way than the Venezuelans and the Haitians. I think there's just no natural solidarity there. And so I think I'm really curious to see how that plays. I think we're frankly in a profoundly dangerous moment when it comes to the United States immigration policy. The fact that there is a sort of groundswell of support for the most draconian policies out there, the fact that the left party, the fact that the Democrats are not only, I mean, it's not like they've ever been champions I don't think they've been particular champions to immigrants at any point in their history, but the fact that now that they're interested in policies that the same ones that they protested under the Trump administration, I think it's going to be a rambunctious 4 years and no matter who's in office. And I think if Trump wins, it's going to be, I'm nervous about what comes next. Then to answer your questions, just really, I'll go through real quick, Don, because you threw some great red meat out there. Evangelical, absolutely. The evangelical movement, I think part of it is where the energy is, right? And the people, most of the Latinos who are either nuns, you know, like don't have a religious affiliation, or Catholic, that's not a movement. That's not energizing. In the same way that evangelicals are growing, they're evangelizing people, they're converting people. Those churches are growing, their ranks are growing. And it's the same thing and it's extremely overlapped with the conservative movement. South Texas, the Republican Party and the evangelicals are, you know, the Venn diagram is pretty much a circle. And I think that that's just, again, it's who has a program, who's telling you you're part of something, there's something bigger here, come and join the club, be with like-minded people. That sort of energy means that they have a lot of momentum. And I think that that's like, when I look at the most energetic spaces of Latino organizing, there's left-wing activists Bill talked about, you know, that the young Latinos who are, you know, gas is an important issue for them. There's energy there. But I think primarily where I see the most momentum, the most sort of organizing strategy and just enthusiasm is in these conservative evangelical Latino spaces. And so I think that that's again, like that's, that doesn't mean that all Latinos are that way or going to become that way. It's just that's where the energy is right now. And so if you're the left party, you have to find a way to match that or counteract it. And I'm not sure that Democrats have, you know, the equivalent of a megachurch to sort of bring people into their tent. But megachurches are bringing people into Trump's camp, right? So,
well, I just want to speak to this evangelical question, because white evangelicals are clearly a huge part of the Trump base. That is not true for Latino evangelicals. They're torn. But if there's a massive immigration campaign, they're decimated. Their congregations are decimated. And the voting patterns for Latino evangelicals, not the highest, but they were Democrat. So I think this is, it's not a, you know, there's issues around women's reproductive rights and all of that, that you know, kind of, that's what pulls them in different directions. But I think, you know, they also are aware that a massive ethnic cleansing campaign would pretty much wipe out a lot of, at least, Mexican-American evangelical, what we call the Pentecostals, in California and in other areas of the Southwest. So I think that explains why, just in general, their voting patterns are very similar to the overall Mexican-American and Puerto Rican voting patterns. It's not that there shouldn't be a concern, and it's not that there shouldn't be attention, but I think we have to look at what's actually gone on. And then I think in terms of the Democrats, the things that that's not Bernie's program, and I actually sent Bernie's recent op-ed to Julia Chavez Rodriguez, but the idea of the $6,000 for new homes, $50,000 for small businesses, those other pieces actually appeal to a lot of Latinos and especially immigrant communities, because a lot of folks, a lot of these immigrant, these vendedores, these street vendors and so on, and other small businesses are pretty much a major part of the economic infrastructure of a lot of barrios, of a lot of communities. And so I think there's part of that in the country at large. So I think there's aspects of this that are really going to be important. They need to be gotten out there. They're not sufficient. I really agree with Jack that, you know, what's being done now is not sufficient, and we should be aware of a danger here, because it doesn't take a big shift in some places to determine the outcome of the election. So in the swing states, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, Latinos have been strongly Democratic. Nobody should take that for granted.
I think, I mean, the housing plan, for instance, like that Bill touched on, like one of the key components was Kamala Harris's proposal for a $25,000 tax credit for first-time homebuyers. I think that is her most, I mean, I don't know how much it shows up electorally, because not many people are high-information voters. But in terms of like the most consequential policy she's proposed, that is a Latino policy right there. $25,000 for houses. 70% of first-time homebuyers over the next 20 years, 70% are going to be Latino in the country over the next 20 years. And so $25,000 tax credit in a place like I just came from Albuquerque, that's a down payment. And so that's an enormously consequential issue when it comes to governing and policy. And I'm glad that we're sort of ending up around there towards the end of this call, because so often we're talking about how do you win the Latino vote. I'm really looking forward to the day when we can get to the next conversation, which is like, what is good governance for Latinos? What is good public policy for Latinos? What's good for us? Not just about what wins the election. And I think that's a great, that policy, again, like, you know, home ownership has a conservative effect on people, I think. So I don't even know if it's a good electoral policy for Democrats. I think the question's sort of out there, but is it good for our community? Absolutely. So that's a policy I really support. But again, I don't know how it plays electorally. I don't know if it actually wins many people votes or increases turnout among the base. I don't know, but it's something we should be talking about, because it's going to be really consequential in our neighborhoods.
You both pointed out something, which is that the Democrats and the left have a problem, which is that the right has a movement as well as a party. We do not have a coherent movement yet. We have the labor movement. We have the women's movement. We have gay rights. We have, you know, we have La Raza. But we do not have, Black Lives Matter, but we do not have anything like the evangelical movement or even, you know, the larger conservative movement. So that's a problem. We have a party, but no movement. We can talk about that another time, maybe, but I just want to put it out there. But what should Democrats be doing in the absence of that movement to draw in and to focus the contrasts between their offer and the Trump offer, apart from as Bill said, you know, be clearer about what would be involved in a deportation campaign. We've already got that ingredient, but what else, what aren't they talking about that they should be talking about more? And what should they be doing and thinking about, not just for the election, but beyond the election?
You're right, Don. I think this is 2024. This is probably the last election. It's the last election that Democrats can get away with the program, which is we're not Trump. That is what they've run successfully. Since 2018, they've run successfully on not being Trump. And that's how they've won midterms and presidential elections. So what is the program beyond that? In 2028, what is going to be the message? Almost have it. Like I think that this is the last chance they have to sort of run on a we're not the other guy sort of policy. And so I think the areas to make the difference, I think that, again, I think Harris has done smart. It might be too little too late, but I think the first thing she's done really well is, again, focus, make a pitch to people who are struggling financially or working class voters, just saying like, hey, Trump's interested in his rich friends. Like here's like your, when we look out and see who our people are, like, you know, Kamala Harris isn't doing this in Spanish, but it is a really sort of like, yo sé quién está mi gente, you know, like, quién son mi gente, like looking up, like, I know who my people are. I know who, like, make sure that, like, she's making eye contact with working class voters. I think that's smart. And I think that Tim Walz is weird line too. Like, I don't think the sort of red meat cultural war politics, like trans rights or Black Lives Matter, that sort of stuff doesn't play very well in Latino communities. That's a whole other episode we can do some other time. So I think that sort of sidestepping the issue and saying like, that's just weird. Like, that's really, you know, that's none of my business. No sé es mi tiche, you know, like, don't, that's just not my business. Let's not talk about, we don't need to talk about that because that's not government's business. That's not my business. It's your neighbor's business. It's my, that's your own thing. So let's talk about stuff that matters. Let's talk about, you know, like getting you higher pay, getting you healthcare, getting you housing. Let's talk about that. Cause that other stuff, like, come on, like that, let's not be weird about it. Just mind your own business, I think that's a winning, if not a winning cultural message, that's a good defensive message in Latino communities.
Well, I agree. I think that the idea of, you know, they're going to create 3 million units of affordable housing. They're going to have this financial support for first-time home buyers, the support for small business. I think they should emphasize that. I think the strong support for unions. There's strong support for unions in most of our communities where there's a big electorate. You know, I think they need to emphasize that. And their support, again, for the Dreamers, that resonates with a lot of folks. And this idea of spousal residency, I think, is a very, very important part of that. But I think the idea of really... The idea that they want to eliminate the Department of Education. Education is continues to have huge resonance with our communities because it's seen as one of the few avenues for social and economic mobility. So I think the idea of what they wanted to do, forgive student debt. I mean, just about 5 people in my family would love that. I think there's a lot of the affirmative that needs to happen. But I think they really need to... you know, I think they need to make clear that we're not just coming out in from September to October, that there is going to be a consistent support for the policies that are important to this community, and we're not going to go away. And so I think that needs to be a very, very important message, is that this is not just an electoral strategy they have, but a strategy of consistent support for this community, this very, very important, very heterogeneous community that has a lot of concerns, continues to face institutional racism and inequality. And I think on the immigration question, I think what Kamala started to do, I think that when he's dehumanizing and these horrible racist terminology that he's using for immigrants, I think she has to continue to say, these are our fellow sisters and brothers, fellow human beings, and whatever the policy has to be, that this kind of demonization is absolutely against everything that we hold as principles and values. And I think that has to be done strongly and affirmatively. And there's, if you need examples, there's a million stories that they can use.
So not just promises, not just policies, but also values. Okay.
Absolutely.
Listen, it's been fabulous to talk to you both. Jack Herrera, Bill Gallegos. Thanks so much for joining us on See How They Run.
Thank you, Don.
Thanks, Don.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.